Matt and Francesca present Seva Matrimony.
That's your impression of me starting a podcast?
Yes.
Howdy and welcome.
Oh, gross.
To Cinematrimony. I am Matt Scalise, your host, and with me, my beautiful and intelligent also wife, Francesca.
But in that order, it is beauty first, obviously.
Sure.
Much more beauty than there is intelligence.
So with me, my trophy wife,
right.
Francesca.
Right.
We are recording this from our vehicle on our way leaving the movie, which is new for us for the podcast, but we're going to try it. I hope the background noise isn't too bad. And
if it is, send money because my car is a piece of crap.
Yeah, buy us a quieter car if you want to hear your podcast.
Right.
Selfish. Mm. So we saw Hugo, and we did see it in 3D.
Yeah.
As its director intended. There's been a lot of discussion about this lately amongst the film nerds about, some guys are open-minded enough to see stuff like this. And you know, you and I have expressed doubts about 3D in the past. There are some film nerds, however, and it's more than one, who are sort of like pretty diametrically opposed to 3D to the point where now, even when a great filmmaker tries it, and all the people that see the movie say it's great and the 3D is better than anything you've seen, they still don't want to see it.
I'm going to tell you what, though. Tintin made me turn a corner, and this made me turn a corner right back. I liked the movie very much. I did not like the 3D.
I agree with you. I don't think the 3D... I do think there are parts of it where the 3D was really well utilized, but I don't think this movie needs 3D to achieve its heights in the way that Tintin did.
Well, but maybe it's that live action doesn't work for me in 3D, because like when they would run, it was like very disorienting and it was blurry looking to me. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. It didn't look good in 3D.
Tintin looked phenomenal. There were never moments in Tintin where I go, this is out of whack. It's not working. I'm disoriented. And, you know, there were a few of those here. I do think there were a few shots, there were more than a few instances where the 3D really worked in this movie for me. But
yes,
not for the whole movie, not in the way that Tintin did. That said...
Yeah, but setting aside the 3D, which, I am still not sold on it as a way to take in a movie.
Well, I'm not saying that I think that it's the way to go. I'm just saying that I do think Tintin... And I hate to already have talked about Tintin more than Hugo in this podcast, but I do think Tintin sort of made a statement in that it's not impossible to make a movie where the 3D adds to it and
right.
that the experience is better because of the 3D.
Right.
But Hugo, I think for the purposes of this, we'll just talk about it from the perspective of being a film, a 2D film. And
I really enjoyed it. It was a very lovely story, which, of course, you know, it's based on a kid's novel. I don't even think it's considered young adult. I think it's actually considered a kid's novel.
And have you read it?
Yeah.
Okay, so you have a little bit of background here that you knew the source material before you saw the movie.
Jace.
And how close to that is this movie?
Well, it was a while ago when I read it, but I think pretty much entirely... I kept to it. I think they embellished the station master. Like, they gave him, like, more of a story.
Uh-huh.
I think he was more just, you know, someone who had to be circumvented.
And spoiler, we're getting into spoiler territory here, but so was his... There was none of his backstory about the fact that he was an orphan and that hurt his leg in the war and all of that.
Yeah, I don't particularly remember that being a part of it. Again, maybe it was. It was a while ago when I read it. And but in terms of the main thrust of the movie, you know, the whole George Méliès. I'm sorry, I'm not French. One other thing that a little annoying. I didn't mind, but I did kind of mind. Was that They're in France. There's lots. There's copious shots of the Eiffel Tower, and they all have British accents.
What? Yeah, that's look. What? That's a that is. This is by far not the first movie to do that. That's a conceit that a lot of movies that are set in foreign countries have. Is that we sort of accept that as American audiences that sometimes we're watching a movie that's in France or Germany or wherever, and the people are speaking all with British accents, and as long as they all have the same accent, it's okay.
Well, anyways, but that being said, that little nitpicky moment being said, I thought this movie was, I was just thinking about it in terms of being a parent, that like, oh, like this is a story that you want your kids to see because it's original, it's about like respecting someone's art and, you know, like, I mean, like, sometimes I try to just boil it down, like, what is the point? What is, like, the moral of the story? And the moral of the story is, like, your dreams have value. And even if you get, you lose your way, like, it's still important, the things you did. You shouldn't try to lock away. Like, it's such, like, a nice and different
story. It's basically just about the value of human, you know, of human life. Like, basically, just that everything that anyone does is important. And In a way, you know, you can sort of look at even the silly character, the bad guy, sort of, with the inspector, and that I like that they embellished that story because what it is that even this silly guy contributes something good, and he was, you know, he was a war hero, and you know, he's basically everybody in this story contributes something, and they have value, and that's, you know, I think. That's sort of being, it's weird to hear them talk about it in a positive way, to say we're all like cogs in a machine, because that's something we sort of think about as a negative image, but they use it as
a
positive thing.
But every cog is important in a machine. So it's
us as being raised as Catholics, I think the analogy we often get is, you know, the parts of the body analogy, you know, where they talk about, you know, basically,
and I can't do what a leg does.
Right, exactly. You know? But that's the same sort of general idea is involved there. All
right.
But you know, I agree. I love the story, and I think it's got also, you know, this is something that one of our fellow film nerds, Graham Flanagan, said to me about Tintin, was that it's a great movie for boys. You know, it's like an adventure movie. That's not trying, you know, it's not trying to lure in kids and make them feel like grown-ups for watching it. This is a movie that is clearly for kids. And I would say the same thing about Hugo.
No, that's, I would disagree with you. While a smart and discerning kid would like it, I was thinking, I'm not sure that, you know, Joe, obese, you know, third grader America is going to like this movie or get it.
I think it's more
for a smart kid. I think a kid who's interested and in likes adventures and is curious and has parents who will talk to them about this film afterwards and would talk to them about other films afterwards. You know?
What about like a smart little girl would be?
That's sort of the target
audience for this movie.
But I'm saying like a SpongeBob SquarePants watching fatty is not going to get it.
You keep talking about it as like a fat kid.
Well,
you think that's who
saying.
Loves Tintin is a little fat kid?
No. I'm saying that this movie is for, you know, again, just your middle America kid, don't think. And I'm saying fat because, let's be honest, middle America.
That's
frankly,
fine.
A lot of kids are obese these days.
I'm seeing your demographic portrait here. I'm
just saying, like, kids with disinterested parents, maybe not as intelligent parents. I don't think, because again, this is a movie that is a car ride, you know, the movie, the conversation continues on the car ride home about a movie like this. And if you have a parent who doesn't engage you on that level, I don't think you're going to like this movie.
Yeah.
You know.
And there's
a lot of,
but I think that's sort of what Scorsese is doing here. If he's making a movie for kids, and, you know, we've read a little bit about why he made this, in part, a big part of why he made this is he wanted to make a movie for his daughter that, you know, that she could see
his daughter,
and enjoy.
Francesca.
That's right. His daughter,
Mr.
Francesca.
Scorsese.
That's right.
Well, you know,
but
again, if you're, okay, how about this? If you get in the car with your parent and you say, Mom, I don't understand what that thing was about the guy with the moon and the thing. And everyone was like, I don't know, that's just weird. I don't like that. It was weird and creepy. Then you're not going to like this movie.
I don't like them old movies.
I thought it was weird when they had them lobsters on their faces. If that is the response that the parent is going to give their kid. I don't know, it's weird. I don't want to talk about it. I don't like that movie.
Jude Law was not enough in that movie.
I want to go see Chipwrecked.
Chipwrecked.
I want my money back. If that is your parental response, then the children are
This is a Martin Scorsese movie, and I didn't see one guy get shot in the face the whole time. I want my money back. No, I agree with you, and I think, but I think, you know, while Hugo is obviously the hero of the movie, I don't think he's a very identifiable character, and I think kind of the character that the audience is meant to, you know, identify with is Chloe Moretz,
right.
Which further points to this idea that this is sort of a movie for smart young girls, because again, her character is, she's very well-read. And she's got good instincts, and she uses big words a lot, you know?
Spoiler alert, not that it's that big of a... It doesn't even really matter that much. But, you know, the movie ends with that she's the one who's written the story, and I do think that's how it is in the novel, that, like, eventually you realize she's the one who's retelling the story.
She's the main character, sort of, yeah.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, I don't know. I feel like Ben Kingsley is kind of your...
No, he's certainly a hero too.
Protagonist, I don't know.
I just mean as a character that you identify with when you watch it.
That everybody just acted the hell out of this movie.
Yeah.
Like, the kid was not kid acting. Like, he was really, like, to a point that almost it had the opposite effect, that I was noticing how much he was acting like an adult actor.
Right.
But he's kind seen of in
too
a good
much
way,
as a young boy.
Yeah, but I mean, it sort of makes sense because, you know, he's an orphan, he's right. Like, you know, but like the flashback scenes of his father, when they would cut back to him, I was like, this is not like a kid being cloying. Like, this is really like heartbreaking to the way he's reacting to, you know, remembering these things.
Well, Scorsese has a pretty good history directing kids in movies, and he's gotten some good performances out of young actors before.
Well, and Chloe Moretz, like, kills it every time. But
she's
the nice
great,
thing about
man.
Her in this was that she so looks that period.
Yeah.
Like, she just looked like a film star from the...
But, you know, that's the thing 20s. About her that
oh,
I think...
What is it supposed to be, the 30s?
No. It was before that, I think. This is...
Well,
yeah,
it's after World War One.
Yeah.
It's before World War... So it would be the 30s, I think.
20s
right?
or 30s, I guess.
Yeah.
But the thing about her that I think is... That, I think, indicates she's going to be beyond a child star, is that, it's like you said, she does have this sort of adult quality to her, where she's not in movies because she's cute. She's
yeah,
in movies...
Jodie Foster.
Yeah, she is sort of a Jodie Foster type, and she's very mature without being precocious.
Right.
And I could just, you know, she's just so... She's just so interesting to watch, and she's so easy to like and root for, and I can see
she's
her.
She's a very naturalistic.
I can see
too,
her being an adult star, you know.
Well, but I will, and she had a little ways to go too, because I felt like I was like, she seems so much older than this kid, and I think she is supposed to be older than him. I feel, but you know, I think she's like probably 15 at this point. Like, she's pretty
yeah,
old, I think.
I think
and,
so.
And you know, I think he's kind of supposed to be more like 11. So I think they were trying to get her to play younger than she actually is. So, I mean, I was impressed that I bought it, but she did bring like a sweetness to it, because I went in going like, she's so much older than him. Is this really going to work? Because there is like a very gentle undercurrent of sort of. I mean, I think it's mostly supposed to be friendship, you know, not like a crush or anything.
No,
like,
they're just friends.
But, you know, I was kind of like, oh, she's so much older. But, you know, she really was able to, like, key in an innocence that made you kind of go, like, okay, well, maybe she's, like, 13 and he's 11,
yeah.
You know, kind of thing. So, good job her. And, of course, Ben Kingsley, killing it.
Ben Kingsley's always good.
Making me cry my own tears.
Ben Kingsley.
The big jerk. And I don't know the name of the actress who was his wife, but she was phenomenal.
Her name
was
Asa something.
I was a big fan.
Yeah, she was really good in a sort of limited role. She did a really good job.
No,
and she
the
has some
scene,
powerful like emotional moments.
When the professor is talking to her and her face is kind of lighting up when he's talking about, like, when he's like, and you were great in the movies too, and oh god.
Well, let's talk about the professor, because that's Michael Stuhlbarg.
I love him.
I know he isn't. I can't quite put my finger on what is so entertaining to watch him.
Face.
Yeah, it's just some. It's just like as soon as he shows up in this movie, you start to go like, gosh, I hope he's in the whole rest of the movie. You know, he's kind of an actor you don't want to take your eyes off of for some reason.
He's got a very interesting and good face.
Good face.
It's a good face. I mean, this is the thing, too. Again, really, all of these actors have good faces.
Yeah.
I enjoyed watching these people on screen. There. I said it.
And, you know, everybody talks about what a departure this is for Scorsese. But, you know...
It feels
very much to me. You know, it's really only the subject matter that's a departure, because as it plays out, a lot of things are very signature Scorsese about it, and you know, they're kind of some of the tropes of Scorsese filmmaking. Like the beginning of the movie is all about Hugo sort of doing these little voyeur shots where of Hugo looking out his clock at people down in the train station, and that's a thing that is over and over again in Scorsese movies, and you know, about especially like Goodfellas is the one that comes to mind, where when he's a kid he's looking out the window at the gangsters and everything, and that's a common theme you see in his movies.
Well,
you also have
sort of
the
a
long
filmmaker being aware of being a filmmaker too. You know?
Yeah, and. And that's also, I mean, that's a, I did my senior undergrad thesis on Scorsese.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah, that was when he was a kid, he was very sickly, and he used to look out onto his streets from his window. And that's why that's made its way into all of his movies. But there's a shot early in the movie, too, where it's a unbroken shot where we're sort of going through the, you know, the... inside the walls of the building following Hugo, and I think I remarked to you at the time, it was very much like the Copacabana
scene. Right, I think I
scene.
Was like, shut up.
Yeah, and then
save
you
it,
told
save
me,
it for the podcast.
Yeah, you told me to shut up there.
Let's talk about the look of the movie.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
It's CG enhanced, obviously. There's a lot of CG work in there, but I don't think it feels intrusive. Except for in a couple of places.
I didn't really even think about the fact that it was CG. I just meant, like, the posters and the design, like, you know, the art that was in the walls of the walls of the train station and stuff was just quite lovely.
Well, Paris is the second movie this year.
Paris, what the crap? Everybody's making me want to go to Paris.
Yeah.
You got your Midnight in Paris. You got your Hugo. You got your Ratatouille. And Amelie, like, can anyone please just show me Paris where it sucks?
Can I bring up another of the film nerds that has commented on something this week? Ben Stark, I believe he had this conversation on Twitter. Our good friend Ben Stark was talking about that kind of the theme of 2011 in movies has been nostalgia,
right.
You know, and
which, by the way,
looking back at earlier idealized eras, and I think even though this is kind of a dirty, dark era,
no, but not really.
It's
is
got
a
some
version
yeah
of it.
Right there's definitely a lot that is sort of shiny and beautiful about it, and you know, and I think the sort of the innocence of film being in its early stages still, even though we're sort of the movie is about a washed up filmmaker.
Well. But who was making films about escapism. And then...
Oh, you're trying to drop the escapism on Ben Stark?
That is the point. Look, that's his point, is that he was making these fantastical movies, and then the war happened, and nobody wanted that kind of movie anymore. And so he thought, you know, the world was too cynical to appreciate the work he did.
Right.
And it broke him. When, in fact, there were people who still appreciated escapism in a film. Huh?
I can't believe I was quoting him because he made such an intelligent point.
I know, right, and that's what made me think about
it. And you've turned it around on him.
I haven't turned it around. I'm just saying that escapism and nostalgia go hand in hand, don't they?
Yeah.
So
I think, well, you know, and that's kind of the point of Midnight in Paris is that nostalgia is by nature escapist and it's not realistic.
We should also mention briefly, Jude Law plays the small but important role of the father. Again, on the rehabilitation of his image after that year where he made, like, 500 horrible movies. Because Jude Law is a good actor and an actor who I enjoy
And you know what? Another thing that I tried to tell you in the theater and you elbowed me
when
was that Jude Law...
Bionic eyes. Oh.
Our cat just is creepily outside our home that we're pulling up to right now. But Jude Law, he should make more kids' movies because he... Something about his voice and the way he carries himself...
Well,
he's,
you know,
he's a really good dad in a kid's movie. He's really good at that.
Well, he's kind.
Yeah, he does. He has like a,
Lemony Snicket in the, you know, because Lemony Snicket is actually the author.
Right.
So I think I don't even know if he has FaceTime in that movie. Cat, what the crap are you doing? Make a decision.
Francesca's trying not to hit our cat while we pull into the garage here.
Oh, this could take
I don't even want to talk about that, if that's what happened in the middle of the podcast. All right, well, would you like to wrap up as we've made it home?
As we have.
So, overall, though, Hugo, very good movie, I would say.
I think for the discerning film-loving set, for sure, it's a must-see.
Take your smart kid to it.
That's right. Not your SpongeBob
fatty kid.
Oh, I have no problem with fat people. I am fat people, by the way.
All right. Well.
And I like SpongeBob. So who the crap do I think I am?
All right. Well, thank you for recording with me on the way home, Francesca.
It's my pleasure, Max. Please.
And thanks everybody for listening.
I didn't really have any choice, did I?
No, you really didn't. You were trapped. That was the best part about it.
Yeah.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Goodbye, friends.